From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is The Exchange on NHPR. Human trafficking sounds like something horrible that happens far from New Hampshire. But in fact, it does happen here. Law enforcement in New Hampshire say it's a bigger problem than you might think, in part because it's often hard to see. This hour, a discussion of human trafficking, what it looks like, how and why it's happening, and what can be done about it. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. We've got some guests here in the studio to talk about the problem of human trafficking in New Hampshire. Three very knowledgeable people I'm happy to welcome here. Deborah Altshuler, Democratic State Representative from Stratham. She also works as the community liaison for Haven, which provides prevention and support services for women, men, and children affected by domestic and sexual violence. Becky Ayling, Project Director for the New Hampshire Human Trafficking Collaborative Task Force at Child and Family Services, a social services agency in Manchester. And Matt Fleming, detective with the Bedford Police Department. He's also a member of the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. Everybody, thank you very much for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thank you
very much. And I should note that later in the program, as part of our Race for the First series, we're going to be speaking with Democrat Levi Sanders, one of many candidates in the race for New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. You can find all the interviews in that series at nhpr.org or by subscribing to the Exchange podcast. And you can send questions for Levi in advance to exchange@nhpr.org. Again, to start the conversation about human trafficking, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And we'll go to you first, Matt Fleming. Establish for us what human trafficking is from a law enforcement perspective. What is it?
Sure. I'm really glad you asked that because I think when you talk about it globally, people don't really understand what human trafficking is, especially what it looks like here in the New England area, which is significantly different than other parts of the country. People have a misconception about that. And generally what we want people to understand is that it is the harboring, the transportation, the exploitation through labor services or forced labor acts, but also through commercial sex trafficking. And here in New Hampshire, that's something that we're very in tune with now because of what's going on with the drug crisis.
Mm-hmm. What is the connection between human trafficking and the drug crisis?
Well, we're talking about a very fragile environment of people who are easy targets. They have a number of things going on that they're trying to deal with, both socially, physically, and addiction-wise. And because of that, they become easy targets for people to pick off, easy to exploit, easy to manipulate, and to force them into an environment in which they feel like they have no other resource other than to continue and do whatever they're asked to do. And that's really what makes it a dangerous, dangerous place for them.
Mm-hmm. And Becky, as part of your work on the task force, you found that human trafficking is not exclusively sex trafficking, but it is a majority of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's both labor and sex. We're seeing people involved in domestic servitude, being house slaves, being required to work in people's construction businesses, agricultural work. But the majority of the cases that we're seeing and able to successfully prosecute in New Hampshire are related to commercial sex.
Mm-hmm. And Matt, you mentioned that the way sex trafficking and human trafficking looks in New Hampshire and the way it looks in other parts of the country and other parts of the world, not exactly the same. How do they differ?
Well, I think what you're seeing now is a definite shift here in the New England area, obviously with the drug crisis. And so because of that, it can increase. It creates an environment to allow it to operate, right? So one is dependent on the other. The exploitation is also getting to become a significant problem because of its connection to the internet and its ability to move victims through the internet means seamlessly without detection. Mm-hmm. And that's another problem.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, who are the victims of sex trafficking, generally speaking?
Well, I'm glad you asked. There's one thing we do know in New Hampshire and nationwide is that 92% of individuals who have been trafficked have experienced sexual abuse in their lifetime. And statistically, here in our state, we know that 1 in 3 women and 1 in 20 men will experience sexual violence in their lifetime. So that is an enormous population of people who are at significant risk for exploitation. And the line between sexual abuse and sexual abuse for money is blurred, really, really blurred. And when we intersect the vulnerable populations of homeless youth and the vulnerable populations of people experiencing substance use disorders and the vulnerable populations of people who are experiencing domestic violence in their homes, those risk factors increase exponentially. So one of the things that we had here in our state was back, it was a little less than a month ago, we had our overnight, I think Becky, you were there, the overnight awareness campaign and for homeless youth. We had 125 people in the state come and raise awareness about homeless youth here in our state. And one thing we know is that a homeless youth will be approached by a trafficker within the first 48 hours of them being out on the streets by themselves, because they need something. They need protection. They need somewhere to sleep. They need food. They need access to a phone. They may need money, and they are incredibly vulnerable. And that's exactly the golden moment for a trafficker to approach them and engage them in what will eventually become survival sex.
And Becky Ailings, you're nodding along with this.
Yes.
Totally in agreement.
Yeah, Child and Family Services is a nonprofit providing services to runaway and homeless youth. First got involved with human trafficking through that population, seeing that it didn't matter kind of gender or where we were in the state, whether it was more in the Manchester area or up in more rural areas. We were seeing young adults who were homeless, who had experienced abusive situations at home, who didn't feel safe to be there, and were hugely vulnerable. And so that was kind of the agency's entrance into trafficking and why we really wanted to be a part of the movement in the state. So we recognize that when we can start to impact that group, then we have fewer people in their 30s, which is what we're really seeing, kind of a lot of people in their kind of 30 to 40 year old bracket that are being trafficked, who are coming looking for services, wanting to prosecute. But we've noticed if we can start to impact our kind of 12 to 24 year olds, then we start to reduce that older age.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what I'm hearing from the folks at the table here is that anybody who is vulnerable in some way, someone who needs something desperately, whether it's food, shelter in the case of homeless teens, whether, as you said, Matt, it's someone who is addicted to drugs and is just so desperate for a fix that they will do anything, and there's someone willing to capitalize on that, that would be an example of human trafficking.
Correct.
Yeah. Correct. Yes. Anything that involves force, fraud, or coercion. So, you know, physically forcing someone to engage in sex or labor trafficking, enticing them to do one job, to, you know, you've applied to one job, and then when you get there, you find out that actually it's something completely different. That would be the fraud. And the coercion would be exactly what you just mentioned, Peter, which would be, you know, I have a substance use disorder. I am looking for, you know, heroin or meth or whatever it is that I happen to be addicted to, and I have no money. So a dealer will, you know, will front that to me. And then eventually I got to pay that debt off. And that debt is more often than not paid in sex trafficking. So those three things, force, fraud, and coercion, are how people are entrapped in human trafficking.
Mm-hmm. Two words that we hear way more often than we hear the word trafficking are prostitution and slavery. And I was hoping that you, someone here, could sort of explain the relationship, if any, between these words. Is prostitution always human trafficking?
If it is for the benefit of a third party, then it is always always trafficking. So someone being prostituted where a third party is benefiting, that is the definition of human trafficking. What we know is that prostitution is built on the exploitation of another person. And so we would, you know, New Hampshire is working towards being a state without exploitation. I think Matt has some more legal definitions of how we approach human trafficking and prostitution in the state.
Yeah, Matt, do you want to weigh in?
So, yeah, absolutely. So thank you. There's a couple of things, too, here I want to touch in on as well that you mentioned that's really important, and that is that what brings people to that scenario is very critical for law enforcement when we're investigating these types of crimes. So all too often, people look to penalize and punish people involved in those scenarios or those situations involving some sort of enslaving or prostitution, and not understanding the bigger picture. What brought the person, the actual person involved in that crime, to the table and why they're there is a key component of what we have to establish when we investigate them. And the reason that is important is because what we're going to do is then look at whether or not they are being forced to do that in some capacity. And so it's not as simple as law enforcement and going to these types of calls and making arrests for prostitution. It's more than that. It's digging deeper into the layers, peeling back that onion and figuring out, why are they here? Who are they working for? Are they forced into this scenario? And then if they are, can we use those resources of what they have for information to find the person who's responsible for that? So what happens is we have to deal through a number of different legal issues and laws when we do that. Prostitution is only one component of that when you're looking at sex-related crimes. The statutes involving sexual crimes here in New Hampshire are very vast. And so there's a lot of different nuances that we have to understand when we look at those things. I can tell you this, that in most of these cases, when we are dealing in people who are being enslaved or forced to do these things, that's not the environment they ever intended to be at. It's not something they're willing to do. It's something that they have to do in order to survive. And so when we look at the crimes, when you look at what's going on with prostitution-related offenses or sexual assault, there's a significant amount of legal things that we have to look at when we investigate those cases. And really, it starts with one thing, and that is the victim. And we have to understand who the victim really is. And that's usually the person engaging in the sexual act who's found themselves there from some reason that we can't explain yet, and we have to figure that out. That's our job.
That is benefiting, as Deborah said, the third party.
Absolutely.
Find out who that third party is. So how does law enforcement create an environment in which victims feel like they are empowered to come forward without fear of reprisal?
Well, that's actually an excellent question, because that's where Child and Family Services come in. So and Becky can speak to this, but I just want to say about the partnership there, because it is so great. So Child and Family Services does a wonderful job of teaching, educating, and making wide open arms for our victims to come in and say, it's okay to talk about what's happened. It's okay what's brought me here now, and why it's important that I work with law enforcement to hold those people accountable. And so I think Becky can speak better to that, but certainly that's why they're so great.
Sure, Becky.
Thanks. So a couple of things that we do just as a task force as a whole is provide a lot of education for professionals, so law enforcement, service providers, medical staff, so that they have more kind of language so that we can take some of the pressure off of victims of trafficking and put it on us professionally to screen, to figure out what's going on, to in a trauma-sensitive way, get some of their backstory, and then share that as appropriately agreed with by the victim with the right people so we can get them what they need. And the social workers that are working with the human trafficking program at Child and Family Services respond to the basic needs of that victim. So we start with what do they need? Where are they? What are their safety concerns? Because all of that survival stuff is what keeps people from or many people from wanting to even go down the law enforcement route, rather than being kind of opposed to that. There are just other more important things for them, like how am I going to eat today? Where am I sleeping tonight? Who's going to make sure I'm safe there? What about my children? How do I get home? So we respond to a lot of those questions and troubleshoot those issues and work with people around what their goals are. And then we can look at how they want to execute justice. How can they find justice in their situation, and what's going to make them feel safer? And for many people, that is prosecuting, but for them, it takes a while to get to that place. And we work really closely with the Manchester Police Department and Homeland Security, who have a task force officer, which has been provided for through a grant that New Hampshire got. And his specific role is to be a trauma-informed kind of law enforcement officer who goes out and meets with victims of trafficking anywhere in the state who really need that help to kind of bridge to law enforcement and talk about their options and get things started. So we kind of help make that connection and support victims to access the right kind of justice to move things forward for them.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Knoy today, and we are talking about human trafficking. It's a crime that does take place in New Hampshire, and we're talking with three knowledgeable people about it. What questions do you have? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So how do you measure how frequently it's happening here? I mean, and I guess maybe the question is, how bad a problem is it here? Becky?
It's really hard to know. We have this grant that we got in October of 2016, and leading up to getting that, law enforcement across the state started pooling their numbers. So what are we seeing when we bring people in, either directly for trafficking that we know is happening and wanting to investigate that case, or for other cases that we think could be related? So people picked up on prostitution charges or drug-related charges, starting to screen those people and say, actually, is there more to this story? So they started collecting those numbers, and we were having about 50 to 70 trafficking cases around the state each year. And that was what we'd use to kind of get this grant and to help us figure out what's the full picture. So since then, as we started to have more kind of social service related agencies collecting numbers, we're seeing really similar numbers just by service agencies. So people like Child and Family Services, Crisis Services, mental health agencies around the state. So we're starting to wonder if actually maybe it's double what law enforcement we're seeing, because we're seeing different people coming forward for different reasons and wanting different needs met. So to be honest, we're not entirely sure. We're in the really early stages of collecting this information, but we're seeing the numbers kind of collecting rapidly over time. And last year, just through Child and Family Services alone, we had over 50 referrals in our first 9 months of receiving them, which for us was pretty astounding and a lot more than we'd realized we would get in that first year. And not all those people were ready for services, and not 100% of them were definitely trafficked. But those were professionals or individuals in the community saying, we're worried about this person and we think that they may be trafficked. And so it was a really eye-opening experience.
Deborah, did you want to weigh in?
So one thing that, you know, through my own work, I work with Haven, which is New Hampshire's largest domestic and sexual violence crisis response agency. And over 25% of the services in that realm are delivered on the southern part of the state. And what we know is that domestic violence is a pattern of coercive, controlling behavior that includes physical, sexual violence, emotional, psychological, financial abuse, and the overlap with those exact characteristics with human trafficking is almost a mirror, you know. So we would experience working with individuals who were being trafficked, and one of the challenges that I think we all in our roles with the Human Trafficking Collaborative Task Force is not only us identifying people in need, but people who are in need being able to identify themselves as someone who's being exploited, because it's such a profound loss of control that looking for spaces where you feel like you might have control over your own destiny is often a misapplication of the word, if you will. And so victims don't always self-identify as victims, and often tell us that their contribution to their family or to their relationship through sex or labor exploitation is exactly that. It's somehow a contribution to a relationship.
Is there a typical profile for a trafficker, Matt?
No, there isn't.
No.
I say that because when you think about what's going on now just around the world with people involvement in the internet, and it's a big component of what we're facing now. So one of the things I wanted to mention about that, and to answer your question, I'm going to go a little bit around it and to get to it, is that one of the fears that people have and the reason why numbers are so skewed and why it's hard for Becky to collect those types of statistics are is because of the fear of law enforcement, because they're concerned that when they do come forward that they're going to be prosecuted, right? So we have to break down those barriers with Becky. But here's what I can tell you, that the face of a trafficker is not what you think. The people that we're dealing with could be the people living right next door from you. They could be the people working in the office with you. Technology in a digital age allows them to operate almost anywhere in any capacity. And so because of that, there's a great relationship that's being built with the Human Trafficking Task Force and the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force that I'm on.
Well, Matt, thank you very much for those scary thoughts before the break. Certainly good to know. We're going to keep talking about human trafficking right after the break. We'll talk about some legislative issues. We'll talk about the signs of human trafficking. If it's true, as Matt says, that these people could be anywhere, both the traffickers and the victims, how can we spot them? If you have questions, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back.
At one point, your car felt pretty high-tech.
To the Batmobile.
But now, the radar for the Batscope sticks, and those rear rocket launchers never seem to work in heavy traffic. So riddle me this. When you upgrade, why not donate your old mobile to NHPR? We'll take care of the paperwork, schedule a free pickup, plus you could get yourself a groovy tax break.
Holy guacamole!
Be a hero. Donate your old vehicle to NHPR at nhpr.org/cardonation.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy, and we are speaking today about human trafficking. Here in the Granite State, law enforcement are fighting it, along with the opioid epidemic, which is a related problem. And we are learning more about the scope of the problem today with Deborah Altshuler, Democratic representative from Stratum. She is also working at the as a community liaison for Haven, which provides prevention and support services for men, women, and children affected by domestic and sexual violence. Becky Ayling, Project Director for the New Hampshire Human Trafficking Collaborative Task Force at Child and Family Services, which is a social service agency in Manchester. And Matt Fleming, detective with the Bedford Police Department. He's also a member of the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. And before the break, we were talking about the prevalence of the problem and the fact that it could be anyone from anywhere. It's hard to tell. So my question to the panel here is, how can you tell? What are the signs? Matt?
So recently we held an event. Becky was there. It was wonderful to have her there. We recently had an event called Hiding in Plain Sight in Bedford, which was about a month ago. And really the title says it all. Traffickers do hide in plain sight. One of the ways that we're starting to get detection of them is through local operations where they are stinging and conducting operations to identify pimps that are pushing girls out onto the street, but also through the internet. As you know, Backpage was out there for a long time and was recently shut down through our partners at Homeland Security. And there are other news group type resources where traffickers post victims. One of the bigger concerns now is that they're being pushed into the dark web. Once they get onto the dark web, it's a virtual world where they can operate completely undetected. And so it's going to increase the amount of work we have to do to identify them. However, we are using the internet and we are using our real true victims to talk to us about where traffickers are and how to identify them. And so there's sort of a combination of both taking place there.
Yeah, I think you're talking about FOSTA, right?
Correct.
The act that essentially led places like Craigslist to delete its personal section and also Backpage. Has that law essentially made it harder for you to find these people on the internet?
Not necessarily. It certainly has helped us because it's slowing down the traffickers' ability to push these poor victims out there, right? But at the end of the day, we do realize that when we shut down at one place, it's going to break out somewhere else. There'll be another fire that erupts somewhere else, and we have to go after that. And so law enforcement has to stay aggressively on the heels of the traffickers to identify the places that they go to, and we continue to do that. Law enforcement networks quite a bit. Becky made a wonderful point. You know, Manchester Police and Homeland Security have done a great job getting that task force off the ground, but that's just the beginning of the conversation. So now that has to evolve, and we have to continue to teach investigators to be trauma-based and understand what that looks like, and also to get all the agencies here in New Hampshire up to speed on how to identify trafficking victims.
Right. And one thing we want to stress is that while law enforcement is now going to be redirecting and finding, you know, where this is happening in different arenas, because Backpage has been shut down and Craigslist now no longer advertises sexual exploitation of children and sexual exploitation in our communities, one of the goals of the task force is to do some prevention education, because the exploitation of children and the exploitation of our fellow citizens does not have to be a foregone conclusion. It happens, and it's been happening for a long time, but we can make choices and we can educate each other in better ways. And so that prevention education is a key piece, particularly for the task force, who Becky can talk about how we'll be getting out into, you know, the medical professional communities. And we've already reached out and have great working relationships with the law enforcement communities. And to, you know, we are capable of change. We know when we know better, we do better. So that prevention education piece is kicking into high gear right now.
Well, let's dig a little bit into that prevention education piece. I mean, what should people know that would help them to prevent human trafficking?
I think some of the work that we've been doing, and especially at the social media event in Bedford, where we talked about how human trafficking and social media connect, is just encouraging families to be more open in conversation with their children. Have some of those challenging conversations. Be brave enough to do that. Know what your children are doing on their devices and model good behavior on your own devices. So having screen-free conversation time, having face-to-face conversations with your family, and being thoughtful and cautious about the freedoms that we give each other and our children when we look at the internet and media. And I'm starting to break down some of those false ideas about what we're seeing in the media to make sure that our children and ourselves themselves know what's fantasy and what's real and what how to be safe and when those things play into kind of our real life.
Well, I imagine parents with teenagers in their homes listening to your comments right now might be quite alarmed because teenagers do a lot on their phones without their parents' knowledge. Help me understand a scenario under which a teenager living in a home with loving parents might still fall victim to human trafficking.
I can speak to this. So we talk about this often with the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force because there's a couple different ways that this can happen. When you talk about the coercion of a person, it doesn't 21st century sexual abuse no longer has to take place in some intimate environment between an adult and a minor. It can happen right through digital technology. And so because of that, these children are exploited. They're exploited through false promises or attention from online traffickers who will try to gather photos from these kids. Once they have those photos, they can now control these kids. You have teenagers and young adults who live in wonderful homes, who have loving families, who would be devastated to find out that their child may be traded an image or a picture. And so in fear of having that get out there, in fear of being exposed and having their whole world essentially be ruined, they will go along with whatever they are asked to do. In some cases, they can be trafficked digitally and never have to leave their home. They can perform sexual acts or engage on stuff online and provide that stuff for the traffickers without ever leaving their home, which makes it a very easy thing for them to do.
Becky?
I think the important thing to remember when you're hearing that, aside from just being terrified about safety of your children, is to remember that we can encourage an open lines of communication with our families so that traffickers don't have that power. One of the things we often hear from victims of trafficking who have had that situation or been in that scenario is that they didn't feel like they could talk to their family because they didn't want to disappoint them. They didn't want shame to be brought in their family. They didn't want to be punished. So letting children know that it's safe, that if someone's hurting them, someone's taking advantage of them, no matter what the scenario, they're safe to talk about that within that home is really key to breaking the power that traffickers have over them.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things, Matt, I've heard law enforcement say is that if you see something, say something with respect to human trafficking. So let's say, you know, I live in a neighborhood and I go about my business on a daily basis and there are things that happen that I wouldn't normally think twice about, but what would be something that if I saw it, I would have to say, huh, that's weird. Maybe I should say something. Like, is there an example of something like that?
You know, it's always tough to say because everybody's neighborhood's a little bit different. Yeah. So there's always little nuances to neighborhoods. But you know, right? You know as a person what doesn't seem right in your neighborhood. One thing that I would say to you that is a good indicator is that increased traffic to a location can be a number of things. So certainly it can be just a busy family, right? But if we're seeing increased traffic at varying times of the day or night, especially in the evening hours with vehicles we've never seen before, with single or multiple occupants, could be of concern. It's worth something to make a phone call or text a tip to your local law enforcement agency, say, hey, could you just take a look at this? I'm concerned about what might be going on. It doesn't hurt to say something. It doesn't hurt to ask. You're not accusing anybody of anything. Our victims rely on somebody making a phone call because it might be that one chance that they have to be saved because somebody thought that something didn't seem right and they made a phone call. That's what they need us to do. That's what we need the public to be engaged in the concern that, hey, it can happen in my neighborhood. The Bedford Police Department took on the project of the Hiding in Plain Sight event because we wanted to remind people that human trafficking and the drug problem and the internet crimes that are out there involving our children are not exclusive to a major metropolitan city. They are a problem for everybody who lives in the state of New Hampshire, and every single corner of the state should be concerned about this type of stuff because with the internet age and the world that we live in now, there are no boundaries. Mm-hmm. It's wide open.
So what is the difference between human trafficking in urban and rural environments? Is there a difference?
There really isn't.
No, there really isn't. And we know that just this past November, right around Thanksgiving, we had a major human trafficking bust in the southern part of the state that involved Londonderry, Exeter, Plastow, Salem, New Hampshire, and Haverhill, Mass. In a simultaneous sting operation. And, you know, I live in the Exeter area, and it's pretty quaint. You know, it is a picturesque New England town. And when I say picturesque, it is on the cover of so many brochures that tout how beautiful and close to our nation's history New Hampshire is, and right in Exeter, on a main thoroughfare, not even hidden in the shadows, like across the street from a major drugstore, next to a hotel, right near our local, a brew pub, with microbrews. There was human trafficking happening, right in front of everyone. So when we say hidden in plain sight, that's not being metaphorical. It's actually how it's happening. And, places like Plastow is, has some really rural parts of it. And to think that you have been driving past a location in Londonderry and you didn't think twice that somebody in that location is being exploited, it's kind of jarring. It's very jarring. So it is happening in every corner of our state. It's not just in our urban centers.
I would agree. And I think the thing to keep in mind as well is that a lot of those stings or the opportunities that law enforcement have to go in and do an investigation come from people calling. So although, like Deborah said, it was right in the middle, some of these places are right in the middle of even rural areas where people go by regularly. The way that law enforcement find out about it is people noticed something looks funny, or I only see people going in there at a specific time of day, or the windows are blocked, or I only see things that make people uncomfortable that just kind of catch them off. That those people who call in and say, I saw something that I didn't really understand, can you check that out, help a great deal. So as those collect, you get a few of those calls who start to law enforcement will then go in and intercept that. I would also say that in our more urban areas in New Hampshire, I use that really loosely, we definitely do have more people outside. So that does increase the possibility of people seeing something that's a bit off and recognizing that they may need to call the police about that. So I would say that in our more rural parts of our state, fewer people are kind of walking around and mingling out in public areas. And that definitely makes it more difficult to spot.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we are speaking about human trafficking and its impact on the Granite State. The number to call if you've got a question, 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. And coming up in about 10 minutes, we're going to continue our Race for the First series with Democrat Levy Sanders. If you have questions for him, send them now by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We've spent a lot of time in this hour so far talking about human trafficking in terms of sex trafficking, but it's also labor trafficking. It's a smaller percentage, but it's still part of it. And as part of my research for this conversation, I saw that some were concerned about a couple of industries and how it is particularly vulnerable to human trafficking. And I didn't know if you could comment on that. One of them is the restaurant industry, and the other is domestic services. Becky, you're nodding. Is this a familiar thing for you?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of information about it. I think in our state, we have a lot of seasonal work opportunities. So we've got great winter sports. We've got lots of summer activities around the lakes and the mountains. So that's where we have our greatest concerns. That's where we've been doing a lot of outreach and education, because those areas where we only need people to work for a specific amount of time are unlikely to draw in employment from kind of the average citizen who needs a stable wage all year, which means that those employers have to kind of find a unique group of people. And you can't always get college students to fill those gaps. So those are areas where we have significant concern in our state. We've also seen quite a few kind of moving job kind of work. So we have a tree farm. People who go out and do kind of traveling construction work where they go from one site to another are definitely at a high risk because they don't have one stationary place of work. They move from site to site and do different jobs, and so they're harder to keep track of. And those are some of the places in New Hampshire that we're keeping an eye on and have gotten tips about that we would love to hear if those are things that are drawing your concern.
Mm-hmm. We got a call from Terry in Manchester. Terry, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about the relationship between human trafficking and the drug crisis that we're experiencing all over this state.
Okay, so let's put that to the panel. What is the connection? Matt, go with you.
Well, I'll start by saying this, and thank you for calling. We appreciate that. There's certainly a concern and a nexus there because it's a vulnerable environment. When people reach a situation where there is a drug abuse dependency, they certainly feel like they have no other choice but to continue with that dependency and battle with that, right? And so through the course of that battle, there's a number of things that they try to do to survive, and one of them can become, getting involved in some sort of sex trafficking organization, or unexpectedly get involved in that. You know, we forget about those victims out there that have been brought in without that design. You know, they've been brought in by mistake because they started hanging out with the wrong crowd, and the next thing you know, they're introduced to something, and before they realize it, they've been introduced to that world, and they weren't even trying to get into that world. And so there is a connection there.
Mm-hmm. If I could just add, I think we've also started to see people who were drugged and then those kind of forced into the world of addictive substances and taken advantage of that way. And we've also seen people who do manage drug trafficking, that world, moving into human trafficking, so kind of pairing that up. And so we have started to look at these issues together because we see the opioid epidemic and substance misuse disorders kind of exacerbating the human trafficking problem. So they didn't start simultaneously or come on the rise together, but I think that it started to make it easier for us to see the human trafficking because these are people who are being exploited in maybe a more kind of easy to spot way. They're coming into our emergency rooms, they're coming into methadone clinics, they're coming across our local police who are out on the streets. And so we're starting to pick up on it. And so it's exacerbated the trafficking issue.
Exacerbated it. Go ahead, Deborah.
It's given us an opportunity to, when we go out and do trainings with law enforcement and with medical professionals, particularly in our emergency departments, to dig a little deeper into their intake process to find out, to ask the questions. Because oftentimes what we have experienced in working with survivors of human trafficking is that they present to the community, either to law enforcement or to medical professionals or to social service organizations, with one problem, but the underlying cause of that problem is that they've been being trafficked. And so we're now reaching a place where we can, like Matt said, peel back the layers and, like Becky said, do a deeper intake and find out, like, what are some of the core reasons why they're presenting to these other organizations.
Mm-hmm. Last question. Hopefully we can answer it quickly. I'm not sure if we can, though. What resources does the state need to fight this problem properly that it doesn't already have?
Where do we start?
Okay.
I think one of the biggest challenges for us has been quick, safe housing. So the crisis services are absolutely inundated. Their primary goal really is to serve people who are victims of domestic violence in that real crisis moment. Trafficking is definitely a part of their remit, but we know that their beds are full. Their beds are always full. So we're really struggling with people coming out of this serious exploitation and needing a safe place to go. And also, they don't. A lot of the victims we're coming across don't have any finances or family support. So we really need some of that funding to support that interim period while they get safe, get on benefits, or get into work or education. And then I think the law enforcement always benefit from the additional support. We have one task force officer who's focused on this, and I think we'd be naive to think that our state couldn't use more.
Okay. Well, Becky Ehling, Project Director for the New Hampshire Trafficking Collaborative Task Force at Child Family Services, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks also to Deborah Altshuler, Democratic State Representative from Stratham, and Matt Fleming, Detective with the Bedford Police Department. Really appreciate your insights on this conversation.
Thank you
today.
Very much Thank for you. Raising the awareness.
Still to come on The Exchange today, it's our Race for the First series. We're going to be speaking with Democratic candidate and CD1 Levy Sanders about his views and why he thinks he stands out among the crowded field of Democrats in CD1. You can send your questions now to exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.